But we will begin with the Namo Tassa. A one, a two, a one, two, three, four. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. The Noble Truths of the Cessation of Suffering. This is the third of the Four Noble Truths. This is the Noble Truth of the Cessation of Suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting. Remainderless. Which is the wanting related to the five senses, the wanting for existence, the craving to be, and the wanting not to be. The giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, never letting it settle enough to grow. Now those, I gave a talk one day about the four ways of letting go. And those are the four ways. It's actually one of my most popular talks on YouTube. The giving up of it. So you just give things up, throw things away, see how much you can abandon. Just like when you eventually leave this place. Imagine how much stuff you carry back. Throw it all away and just go to the airport. Lights and free, what do you need? And the relinquishing of, actually the giving up is called chaga. It is renouncing. Sometimes people think that's just giving donations. It's much more than that. It's like renouncing, giving. You know that sometimes people give these donations, big donations to a temple, and they want their name on the board. That is not donation. That is buying advertising rights for your ego. I Ling Meditation Hall. So really giving up, you give it and no one knows who gave it, where it came from. That's beautiful. The relinquishing of it, see how much you can let go of. And the freedom from it. And you probably remember that story, the monk who went to teach in prison, and afterwards they asked him what it's like living in a monastery, and they found it was much more comfortable in a prison in Australia, four meals a day, and you can have, don't have to work very hard. If ever you want a retreat, you just punch a prison officer on the nose, you get 3 months solitary. And comfortable beds. And TV, whatever you want. And anyway, in that prison system, people want to, oh that's right, they were so amazed, only a couple of meals a day, that's all you get in monastery. And they said, that's terrible living in Bodhinyana Monastery, they said. And they said, why don't you come in here and live with us instead in prison? And that made me start thinking, well, it's the difference between a prison and a monastery. There's only one difference. In a monastery, you want to be there. In a prison, you want to be somewhere else. It doesn't matter how comfortable it is or how austere it is. If you want to be there, you're free. So, in your meditation, do you want to be here or do you want to be in jhana? If you want to be somewhere else, wherever else is, then you're in prison. So freedom is just happy to be here, wherever here happens to be. Then you're free. It's the cessation of wanting. And never letting it settle enough to grow. Because when you start wanting things, you get eventually like addictions to them. The actual word is alaya, and that's where we know that by Himalaya. Hima is snow. It's where the snows settle on those big mountains in India. And if you go, not many people go there, towards the northeast of India, far east of India, you get to the state of Meghalaya. And Mega is clouds. It's where the clouds settle up in that state in northern India, northeast India. So Alaya is where you find the places where things can settle. So those are the four ways of letting go. You give up chaga, giving up expecting nothing in return. So, you know, you give dana, but you don't expect something back in return. You know that once, confession, I received a bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey. Do you know why? It was hidden in the bottom of a bucket of so many other requisites. You know, the Thai people, they'd given lots and lots of toothpaste, soap and stuff in a big bucket. And so, you know, received it like you see me do at lunchtime. And I set it down, you know, with the Anagarikas, people in white. And they came back afterwards with a big smirk on their face. Ajahn Brahm, you just received this. The bottle of Johnny Walker. They hid it inside. And the reason they did that, because it was in memory of their father who passed away. And they have this tradition that whatever you give to a monk, then that's what your deceased father or grandfather will get in heaven. So you understand where they're coming from. And just like years ago, someone gave me some durian, and I didn't really fancy it that day. So I passed it down, and I got complaints. Ajahn Brahm didn't take my durian. That means I can't have durian when I go to heaven. That's not how it works. You give, expecting nothing back in return. Not to get something, but to give. And anyway, you don't have to do that up in heaven anyway, because now they have credit cards up in heaven. So you just make some merits, and then they can get credit on their card, and they can buy whatever they want. That's what sometimes I say, just to make people more understanding. Anyway, wherever in the world is anything agreeable and pleasurable, there the cessation of wanting comes about. So you don't just cease wanting by going to an ascetic place. It's just where there's pleasurable things and unpleasurable things. Otherwise, you know, it's very easy not to want what's unpleasant. But, you know, even not to want what's pleasant as well, to be free from it. And what is there in the world that is agreeable and pleasurable? Sight in the world is agreeable and pleasurable. Hearing, smell, taste, touch, and knowing is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting comes to be abandoned. There its cessation comes about. Just with this body and mind. Whatever spiritual seekers in the past regarded pleasant and agreeable things in the world as impermanent, suffering, and non-self. Regarded pleasant and agreeable things as impermanent and therefore suffering. You can't hold on to them. As non-self, as an affliction, as fearful. They abandon wanting. No, it's, you just, at first it feels like it's going to be good fun, but it's dangerous, you get addicted to it. It's just like going to a shop, and oh yeah, that dress or that new iPad looks so fantastic, until you get the bill. Dependent cessation of all phenomena. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same wanting comes a cessation of fuel. It's the wanting which gets you the fuel for rebirth. Even not wanting to get reborn is another type of fuel. But if you don't want anything, just totally peaceful and still, then there's no cause for rebirth. Cessation of states of existence, cessation of states of existence, cessation of rebirth. And when you end rebirth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, unhappiness, and distress cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. This is the passing away of suffering. Scroll up, yes. The cessation subsiding and passing away of the five components of existence, form, experience, perceptual consciousnesses, is the cessation of suffering, the subsiding of affliction, the passing away of aging and death. The subsiding and passing away of not just your body, but even the end of experience. Perception, will, even all your consciousness, even your mind. So, if you stay on this path long enough, you will lose your mind. And that's good. But in a nice way. And Nibbana with residue remaining. Okay, so there are two stages of Nibbana. First of all, that when a person sees the Dhamma and abandons the defilements, the wanting and the ill will and the delusion, and they're like a Buddha, they're like a sort of an Arahat, still alive, haven't passed away yet. This is the sublime. This is peaceful. That is the stilling of all will. Can you do that? No, of course you can't do that. When you're doing stuff, it doesn't get still. But when you let go and understand how, you can just leave things be, let it be, and allow everything to become calm and still. The relinquishing of all acquisition, destruction of wanting, fade away, cessation, nibbana. When excited by wanting, overcome by wanting. When full of aversion, overcome by aversion. When deluded and overcome by delusion. With mind obsessed with these, you intentionally create problems for yourself, for others, or for both. And you experience mental suffering and depression. You all know that. But when wanting, aversion, and delusion are abandoned, you do not intentionally create any problems for yourself, for others, or for both. You don't experience mental suffering and depression. When you want stuff, we always create problems for things, people, and for ourselves. We don't want anything. We don't create problems. It is in this way Nibbana can be experienced directly. The destruction of wanting, the destruction of aversion, the destruction of delusion, this is called Nibbana with residue remaining. In other words, the five canons are still going, they haven't ceased yet, but they will soon cease at the end of that person's life, the Arahat. If one is intent on the end of wanting and clarity of mind, it's interesting they made those two together. Buddha puts those together. When you want something, you haven't got clarity of mind, because when you want something, you're out there looking at where you want to be. You're not actually looking at where you are. So you haven't got really clarity of mind. You're off in the future, in sci-fi. When one sees the arising of any of the six senses, one's mind is completely free from wanting. You see the arising, just arising, that's all. For one of peaceful mind, one completely liberated, there's nothing further to be done, no need to increase what has been done. As a stone mountain, one solid mass is not stirred by the wind, so no sights, sounds, odors, tastes, touches, or mind objects, desirable or undesirable, stir the stability of the mind. This mind is steady and freed, and you witness the vanishing of the mind when it's really solid. And the story behind that, just to make it interesting for people, because sometimes deep Dhamma can sometimes not be understood well. I was saying this to someone on the way in here. If you understand it, you think, well, that cannot be deep. If it's just really sort of impossible to understand, you think, wow, that's profound. So that's total Gomayang. So there's a wonderful story of that monk in China a long time ago. He said, I want to really go for enlightenment. There is a little lake not far from the monastery, completely surrounded by in the middle of the lake there is an island, completely surrounded by water. No one lives on there. Can I build a small hermitage on there? And all I would ask is once a week, for an attendant to come and bring me enough rice and beans or whatever, live simply, so I can live on retreat in perfect seclusion. And the abbot thought, oh, why not? So he built himself a very simple hut in the middle of the lake, and once a week an attendant would row over and bring him supplies. If he needed anything special, then he would write it on a note and the attendant would bring it for him next week. So after 3 years of perfect seclusion, Mark decided he was enlightened. He was an arahat. So, how can you tell your boss, the abbot, about his great attainment? So when the attendant rode over with the rice and the beans or whatever, he wrote a little note asking for some parchment, a quill, and some ink. He was going to do calligraphy. And the next week, the attendant bought that. He had 1 week to complete the calligraphy, and he meditated really still until his mind was completely clear and powerful, which is what you're supposed to do before you write the calligraphy. Let go of everything you've ever been told and just let the brush flow. And he wrote this wonderful poem in 4 lines, which translated as "The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. And so this is where it actually comes from. When you your mind is like a solid mass, not stirred by the wind, the easterlies, the westerlies, the southerlies, the northerlies, that is a way of saying that you're enlightened. You're not stirred by anything anymore. Like a mass, a stone, a mountain. And having written that in incredibly beautiful calligraphy, he waited for it to dry, rolled it up, and he gave it to the attendant when he next came and said, "Give this to the abbot." 1 week later, he was anticipating the reply from the abbot. Maybe he'd be made an abbot himself. Maybe his scroll would go in the National Museum, because it was amazing calligraphy. And when the attendant came back, it was a scroll that looked just like his. And when he opened it, it was his scroll. Only the abbot had scrawled all these really untidy messages on the scroll. On the first one, the diligent monk, the abbot had written F-A-R-T, fart, in red ballpoint pen, right over his calligraphy. And then the second line, alone for 3 years, another F-A-R-T in capital letters. On the third one, is no longer moved. F-A-R-T, underlined. And the last one, by the 4 worldly winds. F-A-R-T, triple underline, and 3 exclamation marks afterwards. And that was just too much. I mean, some of these monks, just, you know, number one, they're just so coarse. You know, their speech, like Ajahn Brahm, I'm always using the S-H-I-T word. And they just have no sense, you know, of artistic work. And also, they just cannot understand when someone gets enlightened, just probably this arrogant old abbot, totally just coarse and unrefined. How could he do this? So the monk just called the attendant, who was just rowing off, "Come back, you've got to take me to that abbot." So he rowed the hermit monk over to the abbot. The hermit monk just stormed into the room, slammed the scroll on a piece of paper, and says, "Abbot, explain these actions." And very calmly, the abbot unfurled the scroll, stood up, and read out the poem. "The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. Yet, monk, 4 little farts have blown you clean across the lake." And I'm like, oh, I'm not enlightened after all. So that's where that story comes from. You can say anything to an arahat, they just sit there and do nothing. Anyway, and one who has considered all the contrasts in this world, we're not saying this morning about measurements, and is no more disturbed by anything whatever in this world, the peaceful one, freed from rage, from frustration, which is not getting what you want, and from wanting, the stream of consciousness will not be reborn. And Mara asked, this is, oh, I haven't got the quote there, this is the Bhikkhuni, Wajira. By whom has this being been created? Where is the maker of this being? Where has this being arisen? Where does this being cease? And the Bhikkhuni Arahat Wajira replies, this is someone enlightened with something remaining. She could still speak. The body was still active. Why now do you assume a being, Mara? Is that your wrong view? This is just a heap of sankharas, things which have been conditioned, causes and effect. Here no being is found. Just as with coming together of parts, the word vehicle is used. And you all know that in the original it's called chariot. We don't ride in chariots these days. We ride in A380s, in Mercedes, or if you're poor, skateboards. So when the five components of existence exist, well, then there is a conventional term of being. But it is only dukkha, suffering, that comes to being. It is dukkha that stands and dukkha that passes away, falls away. Nothing but dukkha comes to being, nothing but dukkha ceases. Now that is the experience of an arahat. And based on that, well, I'll just give away all my tricks now. You know that sometimes people say that, oh, they understand the Dhamma? And one of my trick questions is, okay, I'm giving it all away now, so anyway. I ask them, does an arahat suffer? Does an arahat, enlightened being, experience dukkha? And some people say, no, they're enlightened, they're free from suffering. I say, you haven't understood, have you? So, of course an arahat experiences suffering. Dukkha arising, dukkha persisting, dukkha passing away. So, what is the difference? I'll say it somewhere around here later on. It is the Terigata. They compare it to, once you become an arahat, it's like a workman or workwoman waiting for their wages. You've done the job, but you haven't got the check yet. But the check's going to come. And the check comes at Parinirvana, when all the five khandhas cease. Anyway, that's what it feels like to be an arahat. Suffering arising, suffering persisting, suffering ceasing. It's always like that, but the arahats are honest about it. An arahat understands the six senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and the mind will cease completely and totally without remainder. And no other senses will arise anywhere in any way. This is another way one knows that there is nothing more to be done. An arahat. That's a samyutta. The six senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and even the mind will disappear. Cease completely and totally, without remainder, and no other senses will arise anywhere in any way. I think that's word for word Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Okay, next one. Okay. Before we go any further, any more questions about the arahat, the cessation of suffering? Okay, one thing I did put in here, it's probably somewhere else. How do you know if a person is an arahat? You will never know if a person is an arahat. You only know when they're not. Because sometimes they can fool you. But in the time of the Buddha, there was, I forget where the sutta is, but there was a monk came up to the Buddha. Ananda was sitting next to the Buddha and said to the Buddha, one who is an arahat never thinks they are better than anybody else, worse than anybody else, or the same as anybody else. And the Buddha said, yeah, correct. And it just happened, another monk came up a few minutes later and said, a person who's an arahat never thinks they're better, worse, or the same as others. Yeah, correct. And the Buddha turned to Ananda and said, those were two arahats. telling me that they've become arahats. They've ended suffering. It's never a badge of honour. You never think, I am an arahat. I should be giving this teaching today, not that stupid Ajahn Brahm. You never think you're better. I never think, oh, I'm a miserable sinner, I'm terrible, why should I? Oh, I've done really bad things and I got reordained. I must have done some very, very bad karma that I got reborn in England, a cold country, with no Buddhism. I just was very fortunate to find Buddha. It would be much better if I was born in a Buddhist country. No, you never think you're worse, and you never think you're the same. The idea of fitting in. You find two trees in the forest which are exactly the same. Impossible. Even twins. Every now and again, people bring twins to the monastery. And the mother understands the difference. They know who's who. But I can't tell the difference between either of them. Remember, I haven't seen him for a while, this Irish man who was a member of our Buddhist society. And he brought his twin brother in once. And they were just, you know, Irish sense of humour. They were just playing around like no one's been. I didn't know who was who. And they said they had a great time when they went to school. Because one day, only one of them would go to school, and the other one would just play around. And the teacher didn't know which one to punish, so he couldn't punish either of them. And they really played that up so badly. Scallywags. And anyway... The noble truth of the way leads to the cessation of suffering. The two extremes that should be avoided. The pursuit of happiness through the five senses, which is low hina. That is hinayana. Secular. The word is gamma. It belongs to the village, belongs to the world. So I know there's a big thing about secular Buddhism. And sometimes what is secular Buddhism is not monastic, no renunciation. It is actually just with the pleasures of the senses. The way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial. And the alternative to that, the other extreme, is the pursuit of practices that fatigue the body and mind, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. That is an accurate translation of Atta Ginamata Nu Yoga. The ascetic practices. The word kilamata is actually means tiring, fatiguing. And that's, I'm very happy to put that in there and to stress that, because sometimes people feel that to get enlightened you have to sit on the floor. Okay, sitting on the chairs for namby-pamby cream puff, you've got no chance of getting enlightened. You just got no commitment. And that is totally against the Buddha's teachings. You look after the body, care for it. Not indulging it, but finding that middle way. And I think, remember Chi Wei, when we were designing this place, that some people said, oh, we can't afford to have en-suites in every room. And I stood my ground there. Said, no, we'll find some money, because you know, I don't give the donations, so best other people to do that. But it worked. Having your own ensuite, your own toilet, making it comfortable so you're not fatigued. If you're sick, you can go and meditate in your own rooms. Because this was coming directly from my understanding of the middle way. Don't fatigue the body. Keep it comfortable. Enough cushions. No food. You know, if you are really sick, you're taking antibiotics or something, or you've got some stomach complaint, yeah, you can take something in the evening, as long as it's not sort of indulgent. So without going to either of these extremes, the Buddha has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, to wisdom, which leads to peace. It's so difficult if you're aching, in pain, sick, really uncomfortable, to actually to get peace. Without peace, there's no direct understanding. Enlightenment on Nibbana. Okay, scroll up. It is this Noble Eightfold Path. Now, a couple of translations here which aren't common. Right view, cannot improve upon that one. Right motivation instead of right thought. I spent all this morning just downplaying the importance of thought. And if I came along here and said the second factor of the right Eightfold Path is right thought, then I'd be a great hypocrite. It's not thought. It's motivation. It's where you're coming from. And I'll emphasize that later on. Right speech, action, livelihood. That's can't get better than that. Right endeavor, not right striving. Striving again is makes one tense. It gives rise to pain and fatigue. Right mindfulness, brilliant, can't improve upon that. And right stillness. And for goodness sake, if anything you argue with, don't argue with that. Right concentration has caused so much problems with meditators. Concentration, force, and they just get very, very tense and have a very unpleasant state sometimes. The stillness, peace, and that's what samadhi means. And for those of you who haven't heard me say this before, there was Junpan, she was a professor, it was at Stanford, who came here. He used to come here for the range retreats for a while. And when she heard me saying this, she checked in the Chinese versions, the Agamas, the Samadhi. And she said, well, that's what it says in the Chinese translations. Samadhi is never translated as concentration, it's always stillness. And that is the Eightfold Path. Now, before I go further, you can see that there is a progression there. When you have right view, then the motivation becomes correct. You find later on right motivation is making peace, being kind, being gentle. The three sankhapas. And you know it's motivation because it's where it's coming from. You're coming from the idea of renouncing, letting go. From kindness, from gentleness. You do that because your view, you understand the plan. And because you have renouncing, being kind, being gentle, of course all your actions will be in accordance with that. You're gentle, kind. Not to get things, but to let go of things. So, you know, there's no stealing or lying, and there's it's giving up stuff. And then right speech, action, livelihood come into mind. And right endeavor. Motivation is the action where it's coming from. The endeavor is where it's going to. Where it's trying to get to. So, and the right endeavor is basically weakening what we call the five hindrances. So the five hindrances are what stop you being mindful. Sometime I'll talk more about mindfulness, or maybe it's, tomorrow might be a good time. Mindfulness is such a common word that hardly anyone really understands it. Sometimes everyone is mindful, even a drunk is mindful. They find their way home somewhere, somehow. So they have some awareness. Only it's very, very, very small awareness. And that now you are reasonably aware. But there are times when you have really powerful meditation, you are super aware. And that sign of that is you can see so much just in the bamboo floor in front of you. So many different colors. So it's like everything is enhanced. Even sometimes fluorescent. You see so deeply into things. Your mindfulness is powerful. Like the difference between just finding a way with a little candle, having an ordinary flashlight, and having a huge searchlight in front of you, which illuminates everything. So eventually the right mindfulness is weakened by the hindrances. Now the mindfulness becomes incredibly strong, and it makes the mind very still. Just look at a piece of bamboo for half an hour, not moving. Not because you force yourself, because it's so interesting. Anyway, that'll come later on. Then is the middle way awakened to the, by the Buddha, which gives rise to vision, to wisdom, leads to peace, direct understanding, to enlightenment, nirvana. The pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, low, secular, coarse, ignoble, unbeneficial, is a state beset by suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. That is the wrong way. Yeah, I mean, you can go and search for happiness and for pleasure, but you know, it's so frustrating sometimes. You almost get there, but then it's you don't manage to reach the destination. Oh, it's disappointing. It's not what you expect. What the brochures say. I remember just seeing once I was being invited to New Zealand, the Southern Island, you know, to teach them Dhamma. And then my host at the time said, let's go having a hike up in the mountains. And they called it tramping in New Zealand, only for a couple of days. And so I thought, yeah, I'm into that. And I looked at the brochures, and it was idyllic. Beautiful mountains and forests and little waterfalls and lakes and nice cabin high in the mountains. Oh, it looked just so gorgeous. But they never told me, you couldn't see it on the photos, the sand flies. You couldn't sit still for a moment before they all got on you and started biting you. You had to keep moving. And we did have some repellent, but it was hot and you were exercising up and down these mountains, so you were sweating, and so the sweat rubbed off or dissolved all of the repellent, and the sand flies were up on you again. The sand flies were so small you couldn't take pictures of them. So what was looked idyllic, beautiful mountains, blooming sand flies. It's amazing that Mara always gets in there somewhere to spoil it. And anyway, that's the nature of the five senses. Frustration, despair, and fever, and it's the wrong way. But you know, you almost get there. It's almost beautiful. It's almost paradise. Ah, the other story I read a long time ago, there was a gentleman, I think in about 1920, in the roaring 20s, when the stock market in the United States was soaring and everyone was making a lot of money. And this fellow, instead of partying, you know, he just cashed in all his money and said, why do I have to live in the United States? I have the whole world. So he went to the libraries and did research on the most idyllic place to live in the world. You know, the nice climate, plenty of food, stable society, where he could live in paradise to the end of his life. And so he looked on the maps, he researched in all of the libraries, and he came across this idyllic island in the Pacific, in the Solomon Island group, which no one had ever heard of before. It was called Guadalcanal. And he built a beautiful home there, idyllic peace, until the Second World War started. And two major battles happened in his idyllic, peaceful paradise. He happened to survive, fortunately. But he tried to find the most peaceful place in the whole world. And it happened to be a battleground. No one could predict that. That's a problem, Mara. You try and find paradise, do all your research, and something always goes wrong. Anyway. Pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, though, is the wrong way. Disengagement from the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses. Remember I mentioned this morning about engagement into the movie? You know, you get pulled in to it. You disengage, stand back. It's only just aches and pains, that's all. It's only like a cancer, it's only somebody dying. Just disengage, it's part of life. Just stand up on a mountain, you just watch all this stuff coming and going. But you're not actually inside of it. You're not involved in it. You're just detached. But detached, I prefer disengaged. From the pursuit of pleasure that is linked to the five senses, low, secular, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. It's a state without suffering, frustration, despair, and fever. It is the right way. So, a person watches a movie, like I remember I did once, Armageddon. Without because this big screen came right down in front of me on the aircraft. And
without the headphones. If you really want fun, you can watch the move without the headphones. You can't get engaged without the headphones, because the headphones always make this music. Whenever it's a love scene, violins start going. It's always violins. Whenever there is an anxious boom, 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 that has the drums, very heavy beat, very fast. Without all of that, you know, it's just absolutely ridiculous. So I was watching this Armageddon without the headphones, and I was laughing my head off. That was a great comedy. One of the best comedies ever, but it's apparently supposed to be adventure and drama and something. And even like, I've never seen Alien, but Alien is supposed to be the most frightening monster ever. I'm sure if you didn't have the music and the background sounds, you know, you'd also feel it's a comedy. So you're disengaged. It doesn't pull you in to the action. And the Noble Eightfold Path is the best of all practices. This is the only path for the purifying insight. There is no other. Follow this path. I was indulging here. I put discombobulate, which is one of my favorite words. It's an English word. You find it in the English dictionary. It means confused. But you say confused, anyone says that. Discombobulate. I mean, that does... That's got class. So, you can repeat that. Discombobulate Mara, confuse Mara. But the important thing here is this is the only path. It actually says that. Ezo wa mago nati anyo. Nati anyo. There's another. Ezo, this only path. Listen, the end of dying has been reached. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma. Now, some people call that deathless, which is a mischievous translation. It doesn't mean deathless. It means the end, the absence of dying. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma, practicing as you are instructed by realizing for yourself in this very life. Through direct understanding, you will soon enter upon and abide in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which people rightly go forth into monastic life. So, what the Buddha is actually saying there, it's almost like a promise. Not just, you know, for monastics, lay people too. If you listen carefully and understand what he's saying, the Buddha's promising that you will at least become a stream winner. Listen carefully. It's a marvelous promise. So, any questions about that one before we go into... Now, in this theme, we go into, one by one, the factors of the Eightfold Path. Starting from right view. Okay, any questions yet?
What is right view?
Oh, it's coming. Yes, here it is. This is your answer. Oh, in soon, sometimes that when you have like thousands of eons, it changes the whole template of what soon means. If you've only got 9 days on this retreat, then soon can't come soon enough. But when you look in terms of lifetimes, thousands of years, or like the age of the universe, what is it? I think about 200,000 or 300,000 million years. So what's a couple of days? What's 10 days? And that's just one universe. And there's been millions, uncountable universe cycles. So an example of what is soon, there is one place where Anuruddha, who was a chief disciple of the Buddha, very well known. And you know, he was a cousin of the Buddha, great meditation. And actually he does, you know, in his little poem in the Theragata, he actually does tell you how long it took him to become a stream winner. 17 years for Anuruddha. Was it 17? Was that the right number? Something around that. So that was considered soon. So sometimes, different timescales. People these days are in such a rush. So, you do all the courses. How long does it take to plant a tree? You know, some of the, I remember some of the trees I helped plant in Wat Nanat Chau. Never thought they would grow at all. We planted them anyway. And now they're beautiful trees. That's like 40 years. But it's nice to, let's see, it does take time. But it's worth it. Even sometimes you plant a tree and you know you'll never see it. But, you know, your children or grandchildren will. It's worth it. So, even though you may not see the result in this lifetime, it's still worth it. You see it in the next lifetime. So, soon can be, you know, 17 years. Sometimes it can be immediate. Who knows? Anyway, at least it's going to happen. As long as you pay attention. Right view. Now, somebody said, the definition of right view is my view is right view, your view is wrong view. And that was a joke in the monastic rules of Bodhinyana Monastery. Rule number one, the abbot, which is me, is always right. That's rule number one. Rule number two, if the abbot is wrong, go back to rule number one. For some people, you probably have a boss at work who's like that, but that's nothing to do with right view or wrong view. That's conceit and arrogance. So this is what the Buddha said. After my parinibbana, that's when the Buddha passes away without any remainder, some will think that the Dharma has ended and you no longer have a teacher, like an authority, like a pope, somebody who you can go to and say, this is right and this is wrong. You won't have a teacher. That is wrong. After the Buddha's parinibbana, the Dharma and the Vinaya will be your teacher. So he said, that is the authority. You know, what has been recorded as the teachings of the Buddha. The Vinaya is like the training. Not just a training for monks and nuns. It means a training, not just a theory, but how you're supposed to do it. Scroll, please. Suppose someone were to say, friends, this is the Buddha's teachings, the Dhamma and the Vinaya, that I heard myself from the Buddha. Then you should check this person's words with the Sutta and the Vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the Sutta and the Vinaya, then you should conclude that this person has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. You don't criticize this person over here who's got it wrong. You just say, oh, you just wrongly understood it. You don't say, you're a heretic. You know, you're an idiot. But you just always criticize the understanding, the actions, never the person. So you check it with the suttas and the Vinaya. Now in the Vinaya, there's lots of information by which you can understand the Buddha's teachings. It's not just rules for monastics. There's so much more in there. Very beautiful little teachings where you can get a deeper understanding of what the Buddha actually taught. And I already mentioned one thing there with the idea of anicca. Now, anicca, people call it like impermanence, but it's not really mean impermanence because they have, I don't think I have mentioned it here, they have, if people come and bring food to your monastery every Monday, like, you know, we have Shirley comes every Monday. That was Sister Gotami's sister. And she's 82 now. I don't know how many years she's been coming, but every Monday she will come unless she's sick or on holiday somewhere. So we call that a regular, a constant supply of food. It's called nicha food. Anicca is its opposite. Nicha is something which is constant. You can rely upon. It's always there. And anicca is what's always been there, constant, suddenly vanishes. That's anicca.
So from the Vinaya, you see how these words are actually used in practice. Just like even like Nibbana. And people think that's such a difficult word to understand. But you read in the Vinaya, and it's like the oil lamp has gone out. So light it. No, and the word for going out is it nibbanaed. Oh, the candle's nibbanaed. Go and light it again, please. So even little kids would understand what nibbana meant in the time of the Buddha. It was a word in common usage, which was also applied to your five candles just going out. You'll come across that later on. So sometimes people think, oh, the Vinaya is just for the monks and nuns. It's not, it's brilliant. And you've also got the, a bit of entertainment. I love this little story. It's absolutely true. It's gross, but fun. This is in Bhikkhuni Pajitya number 8. You know that was coming, didn't you, Venables? Okay. Bhikkhuni Pajitya number 8. Now, in the Bhikkhuni monastery in the time of the Buddha, there was one bhikkhuni who had the chore. You know, we all have our chores and duties to perform. But her chore was at the latrine, the bucket, you know, of yesterday's stuff, you know, the go before the, no, the go mayang from, not really go mayang, but the bhikkhuni mayang. Yeah, that I'd better say the thing. All that SHIT from the night before, she had to go and take it to the pit where it would sort of ferment. But it was early in the morning, no one was around, and it was a long way to that pit. So instead, you know, no one's around, she threw it over the wall. And it just so happened one morning that when she threw the bucket of SHIT over the wall, there was a gentleman walking on the other side. And he was about to go to the palace to negotiate a contract with the king. Now, when you go to the palace, you wear your best clothes, nicely groomed, thinking about the business deal he was going to get, and a bucket of shit all over his head, and his clothes as well. And he didn't have any equanimity. He had actually the opposite. He knew where that bucket came from. And so he was really upset. Those nuns are not real nuns. Look what they've done to me. This is intolerable. And they didn't have electric lights, obviously. They had these little torches, you know, on little poles or trees, which lit the way early in the morning. He took one of those blazing torches and went running into the monastery, the nuns' monastery, wanting to burn the whole place down. But there was a gatekeeper. And the gatekeeper was really smart. Should have been a politician. Because he said, where are you going? Look what's happened to me. These rubber nuns, I'm going to burn their monastery down. He said, hang on a moment. You mean you've been blessed? Now, many people ask for holy water, but this is something much better and more powerful than that. This actually comes from holy nuns. You are just so lucky. And he said, really? He said, yeah, look, listen. Don't burn the monastery down. Go back home. Get washed and get sort of changed. Go back to the palace. You're going to get good luck today. And he believed that. He went back, got changed, washed, you know, and went back to the palace. And the king gave him a really lucrative contract. And so, you know what business people do? They have their little meetings and breakfasts. And the word got around. If you want to do well in business, forget about chanting or holy water or little medallions. Go and get the real thing. What's that called? Come on, say it. Holy shit. And then Of course, that got around to the Buddha eventually, and so the Buddha called the nuns over and said, you're really lucky that you had a gatekeeper who, you know, could, you know, sell water by the river, sell ice cream to Eskimos. So you are just so lucky. But then he said, I will now make a rule. So the eighth Pajitya rule for nuns is, any nun who throws a bucket of shit over the monastery wall has an offence of Pajitya. You're not allowed to do that. That's one of the rules which I'm sure you remember. Venerable, have you broken that one yet? Not lately. So, sometimes people think that there's no humour in Buddhism, but when I tell that, so you have a look at it, it's there. Eighth Pajitya of the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha. Anyway, where were we? Okay.
Only for the nuns?
No, well, you can do that, but be careful. No. Because yours will not be blessed.
No, it's in the
monks. Monks wouldn't do that, because the monks' stuff hasn't got as much power. You've got to think quickly in this job. I'd rather put my foot in my mouth again. Okay, so that's when you hear it from one person. They say, I heard this from the Buddha, just check it out. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from a community of senior monks with distinguished teachers. You should check out this person's words with the sutra and vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that it is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the sutra and vinaya, then you should conclude that this community has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. Or someone were to say, friends, I heard this from many learned elders who uphold the tradition. Then you should check this person's word with the sutta and vinaya. If they agree, they should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the sutta and vinaya, you should conclude that these elders have wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. Or suppose someone were to say, friends, I heard this from one learned elder. Then you should check this person's word with the sutta and vinaya. If they agree, then you should conclude that this is the teaching of the Buddha. If it disagrees with the sutta and vinaya, then you should conclude that this learned elder has wrongly understood the teaching of the Buddha. So just because it's a famous monk, or a community of monks, or it is a tradition which is very popular, you should still check it out for yourself in the Sutta and Vinaya. We've got pretty good translations these days. People like Ajahn Sujato has got it all online now in Sutta Central in many languages. So you can see it for yourself and just check it out. Is that what the Buddha said or not? But of course, you have to have some care, because when you look at the teaching of the Buddha Sutta and Vinaya, you see translations. Even this translation here, which is my translation. And people say, I disagree with that translation. Fine, go back to the Pali, because that's what the Buddha taught. The Buddha never said what now is wrong view. He said it in Pali. Micchaditti. Urupi, King Micchaditti. So he would say it in Pali. That's why it is helpful to learn Pali. If you can, if you've got that sort of brain, because then actually you get much closer to what the Buddha actually said. Okay, wrong view. That is coming tomorrow. Today, we just had right view. I'll quit while I'm ahead. It's 5 o'clock. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Okay. There we go. Okay, invoice and we got, oh yeah. Okay, see if we have what slice it is. I can't just set it up to the town. Okay, wait. Which one is it? Yeah, where are you?
Yeah, we'll see when I get it done.